B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, December 20th, 2016. A quick programming note. I'll have a news and comment podcast for you tomorrow, then I'm going to take a break for the rest of the year. And I've got one more in-depth interview that we'll be releasing tomorrow or Thursday as well. We lead today with the news that Trump has presided over what appears to be a bloodless military coup. Great commentary from Tom Dispatch today. That's Tom Engelhart's website. And one of his contributors is a retired lieutenant colonel named William J. Astori. And he writes in a commentary headline, "Too Many Generals Spoil the Democracy," that Trump, who famously said that Obama had reduced our generals to rubble, whatever that means, has nonetheless selected numerous officers and generals for his administration. I guess there's Barney Rubble and Mad Dog Rubble and the rest of the Flintstones gang. But Astori makes some very important points. Not only are they generals, but they are largely losers. Especially James Mad Dog Mattis, named to head the Pentagon. He's a retired Marine Corps general. And he'll be joined, says Astori, by a real Mad Dog, retired Army Lieutenant General Mike Flynn. And this is creating the appearance that we are going to be run and managed by military leadership. And maybe you're comfortable with that. Some people think that the military is a great place to train people, to build systems, to enforce loyalty, and things of that nature. But do we have a republic, a former republic, one that's founded on civilian control of the military, and we need true civilians as a counterweight to militarism as well as military adventurism? And Astori makes some important points that generals don't just rise through the ranks in some organic fashion. They're identified, they are groomed, they are curated. They're also judged to be safe. The people who can operate the deep state have to be committed to certain principles that you and I might not subscribe to. And in addition to Flynn and Mattis, we've got John Kelly, the guy who ran Guantanamo, and we'll get to Guantanamo a little bit later in the podcast. And Astori notes that while David Petraeus was passed over for Secretary of State, it is proof of Trump's starry-eyed fascination with people who wear medals and ribbons on their clothing. And he points out that having taken off the uniform only a short time ago, career military men like Mattis, Flynn, and Kelly are not truly civilians, and Mattis requires a waiver to serve. They inserted that in a must-pass bit of legislation a couple of weeks ago. And Astori points out that Mike Flynn has served since his brief retirement as a paid lobbyist to a Turkish businessman with close ties to Erdogan, while running a business consultancy that is due to profit by providing surveillance drones to patrol the U.S.-Mexican border. Flynn also has a number two guy, Army retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg. He's an older guy. He served as chief of operations for the ill-fated Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, the occupation, when it was run by Paul Bremer. Remember Boots? And, of course, that was a brilliantly executed plan that left us mired in Iraq for years. Kellogg has also profited from his close links. He has cashed in with jobs at Khaki International, the Oracle Corporation's Homeland Security Division, and Cubic, where he was Senior Vice President for Ground Combat Operations. I don't even know what Cubic is. And then there's General Kelly. long-serving Marine, opposed efforts by the Obama administration to close Guantanamo. He won that one. He also ran afoul of the administration by criticizing efforts to open combat positions to qualified women. And a story writes that despite a six-figure pension, that General Mattis has joined the corporate board of General Dynamics, where he quickly earned or acquired about $1.5 million in salary and stock options. He's also on the board of that company, Theranos, the deeply troubled company that failed to deliver promises to deliver effective or develop effective blood testing technologies for the military. And a story says that collectively, this team could not be more symbolic of the ongoing process of subversion of civilian control of the military. With Trump holding their reins, these self-styled warriors, he says, will soon take charge of the highest civilian positions overseeing the military of the world's sole superpower. He said that this is worse than 7 days in May. Who needs a coup when generals are essentially to be given free rein by a president-elect who fancies himself a military expert because, as a teenager, he spent a few years at a military-themed boarding school? That's a very good point. And he closes with this, put another way, under Trump's team of civilian warrior generals, it looks like the Crusades may come back with a vengeance. Yet for all the president-elect's tough talk about winning, count on for the next 4 years, at least like the last 15, being filled to the brim with military frustrations rather than victory. And here's a case in point. You may have heard about Ryan Zinke. He's the first-term Congress member from Montana who Trump has plucked to be Secretary of the Interior. And apparently Zinke is quite a salesman, because in just one meeting with the Orange Monster, he persuaded him that he's the guy. And part of it is, Ryan Zinke is a retired Navy SEAL commander. And Trump loves to hang out with those guys. Maybe they can talk about grabbing pussies together. At any rate, we credit The Intercept for exposing that Ryan Zinke was caught traveling multiple times to his home in Montana when he was a Navy SEAL, and he fraudulently submitted travel reimbursement requests, claiming that his trips home to work on his home and visit his mom were for official duties. He got caught doing it, and then he continued to do it, because there was finally an investigation that discovered years-long pattern of travel fraud. Now, after he was caught and warned, he continued to do it. And the offense would normally have been serious enough to have ended Zinke's career, but senior officials at SEAL Team 6 didn't formally punish him. He could have been referred for criminal charges or subjected to a non-judicial proceeding that would have censured him, but neither of those things happened. They just quietly said, when you're done here, don't come back. And so he moved on to another part of the Navy. And this operation of the chain of command there, in essentially downplaying or minimizing these offenses that would have drawn a fine or perhaps even prison time for somebody who's not so special as Ryan Zinke, it reminds me of the way the military handles sexual abuse and rape cases inside the chain of command, instead of permitting an objective outside party to manage a case like that. So there are other SEAL team members who are described as incensed that Zinke wasn't punished. Three sources said that the lack of formal punishment was part of a tradition at SEAL Team 6 of avoiding scandal and failing to adequately hold its officers accountable for criminal behavior and other misconduct. That's right. They're above the law because they're heroes. They're commandos. I saw them in Zero Dark 30. Well, yesterday there were, I think, too many Americans, including people I know, who actually thought that the Electoral College would do the right thing, honor the constitutional mandate to prevent a demagogue or a person with undue ties to a foreign government to be made President of the United States. And while Larry Lessig and others were trying to recruit electors from across the country to become faithless. And while many of those electors were in states where they were not bound by any law to vote for the candidate who they were instructed to vote for by party or by the state rules. And what this shows is that we have a collection of spineless people who populate the Electoral College and, frankly, the rest of our government. And instead of honoring the real intent of the Constitution, instead of independently evaluating what Trump means for the future of our country, instead of looking at the obvious flaws that this man has very publicly displayed. And, you know, I don't believe the Russian hacking story. There's no proof of it, and until there's proof, I will continue to remain skeptical. There are issues of Trump's business ties in Russia, in Turkey, in China, in many other countries around the world. And we know that when he takes office and swears to uphold the Constitution on January 20th, he will actually be in violation of it, if only under the terms of the lease for the post office building where he has built the Trump International Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. And so the Electoral College is useless. We had four Democrats who didn't vote for Hillary. Three in Washington State voted for Colin Powell, and a fourth voted for Faith Spotted Eagle, a tribal leader of the opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. There were two Republican electors in Texas who did not vote for Trump, but that was about it. There were a handful of others who attempted to be faithless, but they were sacked by party leaders before they could cast a vote to that effect. So the New York Times editorial today gets it right. Time to end the Electoral College. Most Americans support that. And for the second time in 16 years, we've had a case where the Electoral College overcame Trump, but, you know, that word is loaded now. And the Times correctly notes that the legacy of the Electoral College is slavery and it was the way that southern states were brought into the Union, and it favors smaller states even today. A voter in the state of Wyoming, that person's vote counts 3.6 times as much as my vote here in California. And because almost all states use a winner-take-all system, the election ends up being fought in just a dozen or so battleground states, leaving tens of millions of Americans on the sidelines. Yeah, in California, we don't even get to see any of those nasty commercials that run during the presidential campaign. So the Times is endorsing the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which essentially is an agreement among the states that they will neutralize the Electoral College by simply requiring electors to honor the national popular vote. Even if they're in a state that voted differently, the agreement would be that all electors would go along with the winner of the national popular vote, and that's a way to bypass the Electoral College without actually making a constitutional amendment. A federal judge in Manhattan has ordered the partial unsealing of a government search warrant and supporting documents that led to the investigation of Anthony Weiner's computer. Now, you know, Weiner is the estranged husband of Huma Abedin, the top aide to Hillary Clinton, and that laptop showed that Huma had used it to access her State Department and perhaps her Hillary Clinton email accounts. And so it was justifiably a part of the Clinton email investigation. Now, I don't condone the bobbing and weaving by FBI Director James Comey in this whole episode where in July he said, nah, nothing going on there. Then close to the election, he said, oops, we just opened up this laptop. There may be something relevant there. Then a couple of days later, never mind. And I object to that. I think that was truly unfair and unadvised on the part of the FBI director. The guy who led this is an attorney named Randall Schoenberg, and he is a big Hillary Clinton supporter, and he wants to investigate James Comey's handling of this, and his effort to win release of the warrants is the first step in that process. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And let me single out Alex Croak, or Croaky, who just kicked in $50. Over the weekend, I noticed that. Alex, thank you very much. I appreciate your support. Also, Benny Alto in Oregon, he has subscriptions for each of his pooches. Faith Peoples has multiple subscriptions. And Bob Donjacour's automatic payment is still posting. I'm going to be refunding that. As you may know, Bob had a terrible bike accident back in October, and he remains in intensive care and has not recovered consciousness. So if you pray, I ask you to add Bob Donjacour to your list. And if you're like me, thinking about him and caring about him might be what you can offer. If you'd like to become a subscriber, come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page. You got options there, $5, $10, $20 a month, our $50 annual subscription. And I've got bonus books. It's also not too late if you want to give a subscription to the podcast to a friend or loved one or colleague for the holidays. I'd be happy to arrange that. Just drop me a note, peter@peterbcollins.com. Well, it's another case of tweeting first and think about it later, if at all. Yesterday, as you know, it was a deadly day in Turkey, in Switzerland, and in Germany. But we really don't know the details of these various violent actions. The guy in Turkey who gunned down the ambassador to Turkey from Russia is not necessarily an Islamic extremist. He certainly is extreme, but his issues relate to the war in Syria. Likewise, the attack on a mosque in Zurich, frequented by Somali migrants, is unlikely to be any relationship to Islamist terrorism. And the case in Germany is still being investigated. They thought they had the guy who drove that truck and plowed into a crowd of people at the Christmas market, but they have released that suspect, and they're still looking for the true suspect. But that didn't stop the tweeter-in-chief. He wrote last night, or yesterday afternoon, "Today there were terror attacks in Turkey, Switzerland, and Germany, and it's only getting worse. The civilized world must change thinking." Well, start, Trump, by getting the facts before you make allegations like this. And he loves to be the first to claim that he has identified the latest plot and that he told us all about it. I told you so. I warned you. But this is another case where the president-elect is violating protocol and putting American international relations at risk for his own petty rewards. Today, we've learned that the Obama administration has made its final list of people who would be released from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And it includes 17, perhaps 18 people. That's going to leave a population of about 41 at the prison when Obama leaves office. And I want to commend my friend from Britain, Andy Worthington, the journalist who has painstakingly chronicled the ugly events at Guantanamo. He has profiled every man who has been held there, and he has led the campaign for the past year to pressure Obama into closing the camp. And it's very clear that the president doesn't have a secret plan to achieve that, and that we will have 41 or 42 people left at Guantanamo after he leaves office. And it's really tragic to see some of these cases, men who have been held there for 15 years without charge or trial. And mainly they've been lingering because, you know, many of them are from Yemen, and the U.S. has had an unspoken policy of not repatriating people to Yemen. And there's one man who is considered a man without a country. He is a Rohingya, and I don't have any further details, but my knowledge of the Rohingya population is that they're a minority group in Myanmar, or formerly known as Burma. And no one has offered him a place to live, and so he's going to be, by default, left at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to the whims of Donald Trump. The International Monetary Fund is this murky international bank. They intervene in countries where there are economic problems. And like in Greece, they impose these austerity programs that pay back the bankers and extract money from pensioners and working people and set these countries into a kind of permanent recession. Well, Christine Lagarde is the current head of the IMF, and she was previously the finance minister of France. You may recall she got promoted to the IMF after Dominique Strauss-Kahn had his sexual escapade where he apparently raped a hotel worker in New York before he jumped on a plane to return to Paris. And that ended the career of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and Christine Lagarde assumed the position. So she was found to have been negligent in a case dating back to her job with the French finance ministry. I don't have all the details on that, but she had faced the possibility of a year in prison and a fine, oh, here it is, for not blocking a fraudulent 2008 arbitration award to a politically connected tycoon. Now, obviously, I don't know all the details here, but it just shows that the kind of cronyism and insider back-scratching that is prevalent at the IMF and the World Bank doesn't appear to be changing anytime soon. New Orleans has put one ugly chapter behind it. You may remember, in the hours and days after Hurricane Katrina and the flood that followed, the police went bonkers. They killed people in cold blood. They acted like, I mean, it's unimaginable what occurred. And yesterday, New Orleans announced settlements of a total of $13 million to settle three major police brutality cases. Now, one of them involved the brother of Lance Madison, age 60, and they were on a bridge, the Danziger Bridge in New Orleans, when a police officer shot his mentally disabled brother in the back. And when Madison was arrested on the scene, he was charged with attempted murder and jailed for weeks. So there were other cases, too. A 48-year-old man named Raymond Robert was beaten to death by a police officer in the Treme neighborhood. And Henry Glover was shot on September 2, 2005 by a rookie cop. And a flagged-down passerby drove the wounded Mr. Glover to a makeshift police outpost. And there it even got worse. Officers detained the driver, beat him, and two members of Glover's family, and then they burned the car with Glover's body inside. These are horrific, barbaric events. The $13 million barely offers any redress. And the courts have been very lenient to these officers. The guy who shot Glover had his conviction overturned by an appeals court and was acquitted in a retrial in 2013. And another cop in that case who was convicted in helping the cover-up had his conviction overturned and was never retried. So this is only partial justice, and we need to expose bad cops, and the good cops need to stand up and expose them as well. In Flint, Michigan, two of the emergency managers who were appointed to run the city by Governor Rick Snyder, based on a law that was rammed through after voters repealed the original emergency manager law in Michigan. So it's highly undemocratic what's been going on. And we know that these emergency managers made the decision to stop using the water from the Detroit Water Works, which is a little more expensive, and make the people of Flint drink water from the Flint River, which led to this lead poisoning problem because of the pipes and the toxic chemicals in the river water. So I'm glad to see that the emergency managers have been charged with false pretenses and related charges, and two underlings have also been charged. But Rick Snyder is still at large and not held accountable for the decisions that he put in motion, if not made personally. And in North Carolina, the Republicans are waiting for Governor Pat McCrory, their guy, to finish his term. And there's one last thing they're going to try to do, which is to repeal that ugly bathroom bill. That's the law that was to prevent transgender people from using the bathroom of his or her choice. But this is not free of any political squabbles. The incoming Democratic governor has been, his name is Roy Cooper, has been trying to get this achieved. It was part of his campaign for the governorship. But the Republicans say that, oh, he's trying to take too much credit for getting Republicans to agree to this. And as part of the deal, the Charlotte City Council is repealing their local non-discrimination law that led to the state law that eviscerated their non-discrimination law and imposed the restrictions on bathrooms. It's pretty ugly down there in North Carolina. And finally today, our official film reviewer, Gary Chu, weighs in on the new big screen movie about Jackie Kennedy called Jackie.
Seeing a new film about an infamous assassination on its 53rd anniversary can't be a light encounter of any kind for anybody, especially if the victim is the first person you ever voted for to be president of the United States. That was my lot with the demise of John Fitzgerald Kennedy and seeing Jackie on November 22, 2016. The picture is the work of a Chilean director named Pablo Larraín. An earlier film by Larraín is called No and stars Gael García Bernal. The film is about Augusto Pinochet. Jackie begins just before JFK's murder and stays with its aftermath, showing his widow slipping into deep shock and grief as she demands of herself to maintain while working out details for his funeral and the affecting procession that made such historic visual impressions over the world. Natalie Portman is completely convincing as Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis née Bouvier. Right away, you see Jackie in the pink suit. Sacramento native Greta Gerwig has the part of Nancy Tuckerman, Jackie's confidant and secretary. Peter Skarsgård plays Robert F. Kennedy. Skarsgård is less than a perfect match for Bobby and seems somewhat taller than the former U.S. Senator and U.S. Attorney General, who himself was assassinated just after winning California's 1968 Democratic presidential primary. John Hurt has a small but strong role as Jackie's priest. The script has a pair of scenes depicting Portman and Hurt's characters in serious, deep conversation. Portman must have spent lots of time listening to Mrs. Kennedy's voice before the cameras rolled. She's as close, I believe, as anyone could come to impersonating the former First Lady. Body language and the way Mrs. Kennedy carried herself are spot on. Natalie must surely be proud of her turn in the role. Almost every scene has her near or in a state of shock. The moment she's being interviewed by a reporter, played by Billy Crudup, finds her character in and out of a very snappy mood. It would appear no one pushed Jackie Kennedy around. Crudup, by the way, is a standout, just about perfect. The picture is nonlinear. Crudup's reporter is taking notes for his story and its subsequent publication. At her estate, their conversation is interspersed with the running narrative of events surrounding the president's death. Scenes with Mrs. Kennedy and her two small children, Caroline and John Jr., were difficult. But I'd been through the real thing over a half century ago, and as just about all older Americans did during one Thanksgiving holiday most of us wish had never happened. So in the main, I recommend Jackie for anyone not yet born or too young to remember that dark day in the Dallas Sun. Terribly traumatic scenes aren't used to any great extent, except maybe when Bobby keeps Jackie out of the room where her husband's autopsy is underway. Her brother-in-law grabs her just in time. She and we only have a passing glance in the Parkland Hospital pathology lab. I'm not sure, but some clips used in Jackie seem to be the authentic wide-shot visuals that I remember. They appear to be fresh to the eye. There are genuine black-and-white clips of CBS News correspondent Charles Collingwood doing a Jackie walkthrough of the White House. My most lasting visual memory of this event, though, is simply witnessing the shooting that brought down Lee Harvey Oswald right there on my own television screen coming off the CBS television network. It was a gulp moment of incredulity in the den at my house. "What did I just see?" was said simultaneously by me and the other person in the room. Portman should get well-deserved award notices for her performance. Her character, under the circumstances put forth by the script, surely would be a challenge for any actor performing these fateful moments of Jacqueline Kennedy's life in the autumn of 1962. One more thing I forgot to mention. Danish actor Kaspar Philipsen is cast as Jack Kennedy. He's rather a dead ringer for a quite young U.S. senator from Massachusetts, so many of us still miss to this day. For the Peter B. Collins Podcasts, I'm Gary Chu in Sacramento.
Thank you, Gary Chu. I'll be checking out the Jackie flick during the holidays. I want to thank you for listening to my news and comment podcast. It's available on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.